Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann, and I'll begin with a featured story. Tom Hanks Explains It All. It's an interview with David Marchese. There's some artists, and Tom Hanks is one, who go beyond mere popularity and instead come to embody some part of our shared American story. Ever since the actor broke out from a string of roles as a goofy, lovelorn leading man via the complicated innocence of his work in Big, Hanks has gradually become an avatar of American goodness. Over the course of his long career, he's found clever ways to convey a fundamental and aspirational decency. He's played honorable men on society's then margins, the discriminated against gay lawyer of Philadelphia, and at the center of our history, Forrest Gump, Apollo 13. At other times, he's found ways to imbue with can-do optimism characters who are caught in the middle of seemingly unbearable situations, whether they're alone, cast away, or surrounded by enemies, Saving Private Ryan, or surrounded, such as the malleability of his gift that he has created trustworthy portraits of real-life characters, the heroic airline and cargo ship captains of respectively Sully and Captain Phillips, cartoons, Woody the cowboy from the Toy Story films, and real-life characters who easily could have come off like cartoons as Fred Rogers in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Is it telling, then, that in this time of declining trust in our institutions and one another, Tom Hanks is now playing a bad guy? One with a hand in the downfall of another American icon and mythmaker. But in true Hanksian fashion, he finds something unexpectedly hopeful, even in this character. "I'm not interested in malevolence. I'm interested in motivation," Hanks says about his role as the shadowy talent manager, Colonel Tom Parker, in the director Baz Luhrmann's biopic Elvis, which premieres June 24th. "All you can say is that he's wrong," he adds, "not evil." There's a useful lesson there. With Hanks, there often is. David asks, "Tom Parker was a Dutch guy who passed himself off as a Southern colonel. Elvis was a poor kid from Tupelo who turned himself into a superhero. Both were careful to present very specific versions of themselves to the public. What might a movie star like you know about what's underneath that kind of self-presentation that the rest of us don't?" Well, I don't think in show business there were more authentic to themselves personalities than those two. Elvis dressed the way he dressed because he had to. He felt he looked good. On stage, he wasn't wiggling to say, "Hey, time to turn on the sex appeal." It was instinct. Colonel Tom Parker was the same exact type of thing as a crass, non-artistic level. I heard a story. When he was a carny, he had a dime welded to his ring. He'd say, "That cost 90 cents, and you gave me $2. I owe you $1.10. He would then take the customer's hand, put the change in, close it up, say, "Thank you very much," and cheat people out of that dime. He got the same pleasure from that as he did signing a deal for Elvis with the International Hotel in Las Vegas for millions of dollars. That's got nothing to do with power, nothing to do with influence. It is a dispassionate desire to always get this other thing. That was the secret sauce of living for Colonel Tom Parker, the same way that his hair and clothes and the music he loved was the secret sauce for Elvis. That's them. I'm asking about you. What do you know about the performance of authenticity? Me? You mean career-wise? However you want to take it. You know, I was not an overnight sensation. I'd been in movies for a long time until I had enough opportunities and experience to realize that I don't have to say yes to everything just because they're offering me the gig. Some of that was, what am I going to do instead? Wait for the phone to ring? The phone rang. I said yes. But I was fortunate in that my sense of self and artistic thirst grew at the same time. I'd done enough romantic leads and enough movies and had experienced enough compromise to say, I'm not even going to read those scripts anymore. So then you hold out for something that represents more of the artist you want to be. When Penny Marshall came to me on A League of Their Own, I said, Penny, this is written for a guy who's older than I am. The character is in his 40s and washed up. She said, that's why I want you, because this guy should have been great until he was 40 and wasn't. I went, ah. Before that, a director had never said something like that to me. Come up with a reason while you're 36, broken down, and managing a woman's baseball team. Then it was like, Katie, bar the door. I was looking for more of that from then on. The other thing that happened in the 90s was when Richard Lovett at CAA said, what do you want to do? No one had asked me that question either. People always said, what do you want to do with this opportunity? But what do you want to do? I said, I'd like to make a movie about Apollo 13. That was the first time where I was saying, this is the type of artist I want to be. But if you could look at anybody's career, there's hits and misses. There's movies that simply don't work. And if something's not working is debilitating to you, you're toast. What about trying to make Colonel Tom Parker work? It's rare for you to play a villain. I would say that with the Colonel, whatever motivation it is, the Colonel is often right. And the dynamic that I respond to best is not the antagonist-protagonist dynamic. It's when everyone is coming from a position where they think, this is the best thing to do. You can say, where was the Colonel when Elvis was having drug problems? The Colonel would argue that what I was doing was protecting my boy's reputation as the world's greatest performer. You'll give him what he needs, and he'll get up and sing enough so the audience will have what they want, and Elvis will not be in a position where he's some rock and roll junkie, because he's Elvis, expletive Presley. The Colonel is not going to allow that man to be letting down his fans. So Colonel Tom Parker's motivations were oftentimes self-serving, but they were also motivations that anybody can understand, whether you agree with them or not. David, I think of you as basically a naturalistic actor. Was it tough to translate that to a Baz Luhrmann film? His aesthetic is so much about heightened reality. No, because it's all connected to the logic of the piece. Every movie establishes its own parameters for what's allowable and what's not. Certainly with Elvis, Baz would be saying, you're in a morphine dream. You're high. It's the morphine talking. It all comes down to what the thing is. One of the most presentational movies I've ever seen, ever been in, was Frank Darabont's The Green Mile. Most of the movie is major bum, bum, bum moments. It was all heightened reality and not naturalistic at all, but was the logic of the piece. Did you read the biography of Mike Nichols that came out last year? No, why do you ask? There's an anecdote in there about Charlie Wilson's war that I wanted to ask you about. Apparently, you and Aaron Sorkin didn't want to show Charlie Wilson using cocaine because you thought it made the character unsympathetic. It made me wonder about what you believe audiences do or don't want to see Tom Hanks doing up there on screen. Tom says, let me tell you a story. The original King Kong, they're on Skull Island. They're going to try to save Fay Wray. They're on a log across a ravine. King Kong picks up the log and knocks a bunch of guys off, and they fall down into the ravine and break some of these viney things across the bottom. That's all you see in the movie. In the first cut, though, those viney things were spider webs, and out of a cave crawled the biggest spider you ever saw. What the filmmakers discovered was that after seeing those big spiders, the audience was not afraid of King Kong, so they cut it. There's that thing that can happen in a movie where if you show the giant spider, it might blow your real story out of the water. But it was never in the script to show Charlie Wilson snorting coke. I could walk you through different disagreements I had. On Saving Private Ryan, Steven Spielberg said, I don't think I want to see John Miller fire his gun and kill Germans. I told him, I'm sorry, Stephen. You're not going to get me all the way over here and turn me into some other guy just because you don't want Tom Hanks to kill soldiers. We had the same moment in Forrest Gump. There's the scene with the ambush in Vietnam, and Bob Zemeckis originally wanted Forrest to be confused and run away. I said, Bob, why am I playing a soldier who is really good at his basic training without then showing me slapping in my clip and firing a set of rounds? Anyway, with Charlie Wilson, not snorting coke, was not spiders and King Kong. I would have done it. I didn't care. Those kinds of choices are in every single movie. David, and they're dictated by the needs of the story rather than the image of the star. At the end of the day, the only people who care about your image in a movie is the marketing department. You know, the gunfighter with Gregory Peck. Gregory Peck had a mustache in that, and the guy who ran the studio said, that mustache on Gregory Peck cost us millions at the box office. What he was saying was, thanks a lot for putting spiders in King Kong. But, and not to belabor this point, if you're going to show Charlie Wilson in a hot tub with naked girls in Las Vegas doing coke, then he better be coked up for the rest of the scenes in Las Vegas. He better be gnashing his teeth. He better be talking fast. If we were going to do it, we would have said, let's do that right. But that's not what was going on. Okay, what else can I explain for you? You talked about a point earlier in your career when you wanted to get out of a particular box. Have you ever been concerned during the later part of your career that you've been stuck in a different box? You mean the hero, the guy who could be trusted, the ordinary guy that gets put in extraordinary circumstances? I look at it like this. I have a particular cinematic countenance that I carry into any movie, the same way that De Niro carries a malevolence into every role that he plays. There can be new ways to explore what that means. For example, when Clint Eastwood said, you want to be Sully? I said to him, I've sort of played that role before. And he said, yeah, you have. I took that as a challenge. It's like he was saying there's still an unplumbed thing. Gary Cooper, and Humphrey Bogart, and Betty Davis, and Jimmy Stewart, they brought their countenance into every movie and were looking for some new turn of it. There's no shiny object you wave at the audience to make them forget that countenance. So the biggest question you have to ask is their new character's behavior authentic to recognizable human behavior? Let's take Greyhound. Tom Hanks in a uniform. Geez, we haven't seen this enough. Me doing the right thing. Oh, that's brand new. All of that stuff is in the movie, but it's through a filter of a character who's scared out of his head, and that's different. It's the same countenance and the same, trust me, folks, but the cost becomes palpable. Can an actor consciously use his countenance in a performance? And does that countenance reveal anything innate? No, I don't think you're going to know the person through performance. But the piling up of the jobs themselves, if someone has only seen half of my movies, they've still seen 30 movies. Over the course of that will come some imprimatur. Cannot be denied. But that doesn't mean it's not malleable. It is, provided you're not just doing the same thing. You got to give them A, you got to give them B, but if you don't also give them K and S, you're going to start delivering movies by rote. Mr. Bruce Springsteen said his rock and roll show is like going to church, provided that what he does in the big shows is give you 6 songs in a row that are Bruce Springsteen, it is absolute E Street bandiest. After that, he takes you anywhere he wants. It's not exactly the same with movies, but the audience expects a thing from my name up there. I'm not saying they come in expecting something specific, but they're going to trust me in making my choice to do the movie in the first place. Let's go for a ride with this guy because he's only let us down 1 time out of 2. He's still battling 500. You can't pretend it doesn't exist, but no matter what, here's what you always want people saying after a movie. I'm glad we went to the movies today. What is worse than going to a movie and coming out and saying, could have seen that on a plane? So many of your movies, and also the work you do with Playtone convey an affection for a particular slice of mid-20th century America. That's a period, the period of our youth, that makes a lot of people nostalgic. But nostalgia for that time has curdled for so many Americans into retrograde politics. What makes Back in My Day tip over into something negative for some people? And why do you think it hasn't for you? That's such a loathsome argument, Back in My Day. Those days were expletive up. Oh, the 50s were this carefree time. Excuse me? They were not. How come things aren't the way they were? You mean when you were comfortable? Institutions were gaming the system in order to maintain the status quo. That has always been the case, except for when some redefinition of our institutions comes along out of a public outcry because the status quo isn't fair. I was in a movie called Cloud Atlas that went right over everybody's head. It said, "What is the point of trying to do the right thing when it's just a drop in the ocean? But what is an ocean but a multitude of drops? Things get better when a multitude of drops form an ocean and sweep things away." World War II. The Nazis were defeated, as was a Japanese empire, because enough good people said no. Civil rights came about because of, I think, an American belief that our responsibility as citizens is to work toward making a more perfect union. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but there's Hanks. He's got a nostalgia for the way America used to be. No, I have a fascination with the progress that America has made in all these incremental moments. That is an American sense of what is right and what is wrong. What I don't do, if I can continue on, I'm not cynical. Cynicism is a default position in an awful lot of entertainment. How many knockoff versions of Chinatown have you seen? 8 million. The conflict of cynicism is glamorous, gorgeous. Violence is glamorous and gorgeous. But it's cynical. And I'm not a cynic. Making those Robert Langdon sequels, wasn't that a little cynical? Oh, God, that was a commercial enterprise. Yeah, those Robert Langdon sequels were hooey. The Da Vinci Code was hooey. I mean, Dan Brown, God bless him, says, "Here is a sculpture in a place in Paris." No, it's way over there. See how a cross is formed on a map? Well, it's sort of a cross. Those are delightful scavenger hunts that are about as accurate to history as the James Bond movies are to espionage. But they're as cynical as a crossword puzzle. All we were doing is promising a diversion. There's nothing wrong with good commerce, provided it is good commerce. By the time we made the third one, we proved that it wasn't such a good commerce. Let me tell you something else about the Da Vinci Code. It was my 40th-something birthday. We were shooting in the Louvre at night. I changed my pants in front of the Mona Lisa. They brought me a birthday cake in the Grand Salon. Who gets to have that experience? Any cynicism there? Hell no. David, just to stick with the idea of cynicism for a moment, I was always intrigued by the idea that you and Martin Scorsese tried to make a Dean Martin biopic. I think of him as a profoundly cynical star. What drew you to him? I didn't see Dean Martin as being the cynical presence in the Rat Pack. I think he's the only one who got it. Dean Martin was not into any of the show business razzle-dazzle, except for the way it gave him a degree of ease and enjoyment that he wanted because he grew up so hard-scrabble. He said, "Pally, there's got to be an easier way." And he discovered what that way was. It's a great story about Dean Martin. After he broke up with Jerry Lewis, everybody said, "Jerry is a genius. Dean's just a crooner." Dean then went to Las Vegas, and it was a disaster. He comes back and says to one of his guys, "They don't seem to like me without the monkey boy. What are we going to do?" I'm paraphrasing. The guy said, "You could always do the drunky act." So from that drunky act came jokes like, "I don't drink anymore. I just freeze it and eat it like a popsicle." He was not a boozer. When he's out there with the Rat Pack, it's apple juice in his glass. He would pretend not to know his lines. I'd like to have a response to that joke, but I'll have to wait for Mr. Cue Card Man to do his job. This was all fake. What is that other than an expertise beyond belief? That's why I wanted to do it. I felt like I understood that guy to a T. Also, I've heard this story about Dean and Jerry at the end of their lives. Jerry was in some restaurant and Dean came in, did not say hello, just took his seat. Jerry said, "I have to go talk to Dean." Understand, the night they broke up at the Copacabana, Jerry said to Dean, "What we had all this time was love." Dean said, "You know what you were to me? A big, fat, expletive dollar sign." But at the end, they're old, they're infirm, and they just sat and held hands at some restaurant, weeping. Forgive me if I'm telling you too much about the movie we never made. No, I asked, but now I'm thinking about what you said about the struggle toward a more perfect union, and I'm thinking about it in the context of the op-ed you wrote last year about the Tulsa race massacre. That came out of unadulterated frustration. I consider myself a student. I read history for pleasure. When I found out about Tulsa, the question I had was, why had I not heard about Tulsa? Quite frankly, that led into a personal enlightenment. David, so my question is whether the stories you want to tell about America need to have a redemptive element in order for you to want to tell them. Because your American history projects almost always offer some redeeming idea about the country's values and its people's character. But are there certain kinds of American stories, like Tulsa, which maybe don't offer anything redemptive that you wouldn't be comfortable telling? You have to take into account the economics of what I do for a living. We come along and say, we would like $250 million. In the case of Masters of the Air, to do a 10-part miniseries. About what? Americans bombing Nazis. That's pretty commercial to me, but how are we going to do that? One of the things we're going to do is show the cost of what it took in order to do that. It was brutal. The 8th Air Force suffered half of the U.S. Air Force's casualties. It's not just, yay, we bombed the Nazis. It's, we bombed the Nazis, and the pressure of doing that expletive up so many Americans. Then, we can't go back and just show white people saving the world, because the black airmen who got shot down were in these Stalags, too. So you're going to see black people. You're going to see these young kids who are just like their white counterparts, the same exact kind of prisoners of war, knowing that when they get home, the land they come from is institutionally racist. So to answer your question, this stuff costs money, and it has to make money. That means we have to sneak up on the trickier stuff. Now, you're not a naive guy, but honestly, some people say, how come you didn't make a movie about blah bitty blah blah? They think that you get to make any movie you want. That is simply not the fact. We had an opportunity in Masters of the Air to show segregated pilots in the same prisoner of war camp as everybody else, and it's the truth. If you don't see that, if you don't learn about Tulsa, that is saying you're going to keep this rosy-eyed idea of the past. But as soon as you bring it up, that's the movement toward a more perfect union. This happened. Know it. Because if you know that, you know who we are. You talked about an American sense of right and wrong. Has your faith in that sense been shaken? There's a million obvious reasons for what would cause that to happen, and then also less obvious ones, like the fact that some portion of people believe you're involved with QAnon. That's got to give you pause. Look, there's plenty of reason to be demoralized. Goodness is not a constant, and the good fight is not always fought. But there's a strength and a resiliency and an eventuality to vox populi. There are events that shake up those Americans who still believe there is a right way to do things. It's the Peter Finch moment. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Now, a certain administration came down the pike, and the people who were screaming seemed to rule the day. Why? Because the people who cared about what's right didn't show up. Well, something egregious comes along, and guess what? People will show up. But their cages have to be rattled. We might be experiencing that right now. The problem, of course, is that technology has shifted so that truth has no currency. That's only going to be altered when people say, expletive that. I'm not going to pay any attention to social media ever again. Is that why you stopped tweeting? It's been 2 years since you posted anything. I stopped posting because, number one, I thought it was an empty exercise. I have enough attention on me. But also, I'd post something goofy like, here's a pair of shoes I saw in the middle of the street. And the third comment would be, expletive you, Hanks. I don't know if I want to give that guy that the forum. If the third comment is, expletive you, you Obama-loving communist, it's like, I don't need to do that. We've been talking a bunch about cultural shifts. I want to ask about cultural shifts related to the two movies you won Oscars for. Timely movies at the time that you might not be able to make now. That's exactly it. There's no way a straight actor would be cast in Philadelphia today, and Forrest Gump would be dead in the water. Cary Sinise would not have been able to play Lieutenant Dan because he has legs. Not that. I'm positive that its premise alone would mean that Forrest Gump would be mocked and picked apart on social media before anyone even had a chance to see it. Tom, there's nothing you can do about that, but let's address, could a straight man do that, do what I did in Philadelphia now? No, and rightly so. The whole point of Philadelphia was don't be afraid. One of the reasons people weren't afraid of that movie is that I was playing a gay man. We're now beyond that, and I don't think people would accept the inauthenticity of a straight guy playing a gay guy. It's not a crime. It's not boo-hoo that someone would say we're going to demand more of a movie in the modern realm of authenticity. Do I sound like I'm preaching? I don't mean to. Do the generational politics of Forrest Gump register any differently to you today than they did in 1994? What do you mean? I mean, do you remember when you were in that movie? Yes, I was in the movie. Damn it, I sound like Chris Farley interviewing Paul McCartney on Saturday Night Live. Laugh. How about when you sang that song? Do you remember that? Okay, so I also assume you remember the discourse when Forrest Gump was up against Pulp Fiction at the Oscars. Your movie was held up as this totem of boomer nostalgia, and the other movie was the fresh new thing. Rightly so, not inaccurate. So, with the benefit of hindsight, do you think Forrest Gump overcame its nostalgic impulses or succumbed to them? Oh, it overcame them. The problem with Forrest Gump is it made $1 billion. If we just made a successful movie, Bob and I would have been geniuses. But because we made a wildly successful movie, we were diabolical geniuses. It's a bad problem to have? No, but is it a bad problem to have? No, but there's books of the greatest movies of all time, and Forrest Gump doesn't appear because, oh, it's this sappy nostalgia fest. Every year there's an article that goes, the movie that should have won Best Picture, and it's always Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction is a masterpiece without a doubt. Look, I don't know, but there's a moment of undeniable, heartbreaking humanity in Forrest Gump when Gary Sinise, he's playing Lieutenant Dan, and his Asian wife walk up to our house on the day that Forrest and Jenny get married. Magic legs. Yes, magic legs. Then I look at him and I say, Lieutenant Dan, I might get weepy thinking about it now. Forrest and Lieutenant Dan and those four words, magic legs, Lieutenant Dan. Understand all they had been through and feel gratitude for every ounce of pain and tragedy that they survived. That's some intangible expletive right there. That is not just running along to Duane Eddy's rebel rouser. David, the early 90s were clearly an important time for you in figuring out what you wanted to do with your career. Have you had any similar epiphanies since then? I'll tell you this anecdote. There was a period of time when my wife and I were invited to all these primo dinners. You walk into the restaurant like, holy cow, Swifty Lazar is still alive. And Sophia Loren is at another table. And I'm sitting with Tony Curtis. I might have asked him a question about a famous movie he'd done. You don't want to foam all over people at dinner. You don't want to do the Chris Farley. Remember when you were in Some Like It Hot? Like you did? Yeah. Right. So Tony says, how old are you, Tom? I was just about to turn 40. And he said, you know, just before I turned 40, it wasn't Dori Sherry, but I'm going to use the name. Dori Sherry called me and he said, Tony, you're going into your 40s. I want you to put your head down and do great work. And by the time you're 50, you'll be an international movie star. That's exactly what Tony Curtis did. Somewhere between his mid-30s and his mid-40s, he might have fudged the age, he was doing Spartacus and the Vikings and Sex and the Single Girl. That's when Tony Curtis became big-time Tony Curtis. I guess I did a bit of that because going into my 40s, there was a constant stream of people wanting me to be in movies with them. I ended up saying no to an awful lot of things, and the things I said yes to were pretty damn good, and I had a nice run. But Tom's the ordinary guy in extraordinary circumstances. I aged out of that. You can only do it for so long. So what's left to do? If I can't generate the things I want to do at Playtone, I will be some brand of gun for hire. It's not a bad way to go about things. When I did Nora Ephron's play, Lucky Guy, that was a conscious decision to cut down on the exposure. I wanted to do extraordinary work, but I also wanted to not be carrying the economic burden of another big-ass movie. Because as soon as you carry one of those and it tanks, you're in the doghouse for a while. It's that old story. Get me Tom Hanks. Get me the next Tom Hanks. Get me the young Tom Hanks. Who's Tom Hanks? But that's the business. You can't change that. Is this the longest you've ever been interviewed without getting asked about being nice? Am I nice? I don't know. I heard you kicked hooch. I have never kicked hooch. That was a joke. You know, it's funny you say that about the nice thing. How many times have I been having a conversation with some journalist who wanted to say something unique, and then the whole first paragraph is he nice or not? It just goes on and on. I have one last question. When I asked for a memory from your career, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Okay, we were shooting the park bench scenes of Forrest Gump. It's summertime in Savannah, Georgia. We had shot 27 straight days. It was brutal. We were sitting there, and I got this haircut. We're trying to make sense of this dialogue, and I had to say, Bob, man, I don't think anybody's going to care. And Bob said, it's a minefield, Tom. You never know what's good. Are you going to make it through safe? Or are you going to step on a bouncing Betty that's going to blow your balls off? There's never any guarantee. I'll be 66 in July, and I've been acting for a paycheck since I was 20. 46 years, and I now know what was evident when I was 20 years old is what Spencer Tracy said. Learn the lines, hit the marks, tell the truth. That's all you can do. And now I'll read a letter of recommendation. You need a horror movie friend for a more frightening, less lonely life. You can't undo what's terrible about the universe, but you can stand against it together. It's a story by Adrian Celt, or Kelt. I was in graduate school when I realized the importance of having a designated horror friend. I spent a lot of time in creative writing workshops, moderating my tone to sound productive while offering my peers feedback on their work. We were all careful with one another, but a layer of brutality ran just below the surface, an implicit understanding that sometimes calling a classmate's story interesting meant you actually thought it was trash. Our politeness kept the program from descending into violence, but it sometimes left me craving a more honest, instinctual response. One thing that helped keep me sane was horror cinema. Horror is a natural companion to the experimental fiction that I love. Clarice Lispector, Renata Adler, Samuel Beckett, James Joyce, in the sense of its belief that underneath ordinary reality lies a second and darker layer of existence. In these films, mood is not subservient to message. The mood is the message, working to disperse the sedative haze of the everyday. Not everyone in the program was receptive to this point of view. So it meant something to me when a classmate named Angie suggested that we meet up to see Let the Right One In at the second-run movie theater in town. It wasn't a natural pick for a friend date, huddling together in the dark and watching the story of a child-sized vampire ensnaring a young boy into emotional slavery. Even the theater was strange, its lobby full of humming, buzzing, life-size animatronics you had to walk past to get to the box office. But Angie seems excited, and I said yes, trying not to let myself hope that this would be more than a one-time thing. After getting our tickets, we settled in with cheap popcorn and soda, and as the lights dimmed in the theater, Angie leaned over and whispered in my ear about a Twin Peaks-themed Halloween party they were planning to throw and a classic slasher movie we should watch together soon. I saw the future unspool before me, more frightening, less lonely. A lot of people hate horror movies, but I don't. In fact, I frequently find myself strong-arming my friends and loved ones into watching something scarier than they would prefer just for the company. It's a difference of philosophy as much as a difference in taste. Horror deniers often claim there's nothing emotionally valuable in the experience of being frightened. I disagree. When I first watched The Last Unicorn, a horror movie masquerading as a children's cartoon, at age 8, the image of a naked harpy devouring a witch was burned into my brain, but so was the realization that the conditions that created the harpy also allowed for the unicorn. The existence of horror is inevitably proximate to the existence of wondrous possibility. Meeting another person who loves horror as much as I do, then, is like meeting a fellow traveler from my home country while stuck somewhere distant and strange. There's a shiver of recognition, a sense of immediate union. Of course, I can watch horror movies by myself. I frequently do because my husband doesn't like them. But choosing to be scared with another person means choosing to be vulnerable together, which creates a bond that can't be replicated any other way. Angie and I built our friendship on horror cinema of all types and quality, from David Cronenberg to David Lynch to every installment of The Purge. We cringed at the body horror in Goodnight Mommy, lips sealed with super glue, a cockroach crawling into someone's mouth, and celebrated when Florence Pugh's bad boyfriend in Midsommar was burned alive inside a bear. But it wasn't just the movies that we loved. It was the fact that when we watched them together, our mutual appreciation amplified their strength. Horror movies articulate that the world is horrible and that the most horrible thing of all is simply that we are alive and fragile and bound for death. There's no protection from this. No other way out of this life. People you love will get sick. Maybe you will. Violence will be done by charismatic strangers, and worse still, by lovers and friends. But sharing that understanding with someone makes the world perhaps paradoxically less scary. You can't undo what is terrible about the universe, but you can stand against it together. Recently, I was outside exercising when my dog started barking by the back gate. I looked up and saw a man in a black ski mask standing in my backyard by my bicycle. An image simultaneously so legible, man, mask, and incomprehensible. Stranger, why? That my mind went blank. The man noticed me staring and gave a casual wave before strolling to the fence and jumping over. There are places in the world where reality bends. Dark alleys, calls from unknown numbers, a sudden face where a face should not be. These are tropes in horror fiction for a reason, and one of them had just appeared in my yard. I was vulnerable and never had this fact been clearer to me. But strange to say, I found it as exhilarating as scary, perhaps because I'd been preparing for this moment my whole life, and because I knew that I was not alone, because someone had been preparing with me. I ran inside, and after my husband and I called the police, I called Angie. Adrian Selt, the author, is the author of Daughters, Invitation to a Bonfire, and most recently, End of the World House. Now another featured story, Developers Embrace Passion for Pickleball. The growing sport has lured investors eager to cash in on its popularity, opening courts in former warehouses and vacant big box stores, and adding food and other entertainment options. This is a story by Seth Berkman. Vandalism, claims of torture, and pressure campaigns are just some of the heavy-handed tactics enthusiasts have encountered in their quest to find a decent court to play their favorite sport, pickleball. A combination of badminton, tennis, and ping pong, pickleball was invented in 1965 as an easy-to-play pastime. After years of quiet popularity, it grew in popularity during the coronavirus pandemic, and devotees now cite it as one of the fastest-growing games in the United States. Sponsors and television networks are showing some interest in the sport, as are celebrities like Jamie Foxx, Stephen Colbert, and Ellen DeGeneres. Pickleball has divided some communities over noise complaints and turf wars, but not all experiences resemble plots fit for a mafia trial. Some cities are embracing the sport. Recently, Redondo Beach, California, budgeted $65,000 for new courts and a feasibility study on possibly adding more. Lincoln, Nebraska's already spent $200,000 for new courts and is creating a master plan for further expansion. Without dedicated municipal interest, though, it's becoming harder to find acceptable places to play in many cities, and private developers are jumping on the opportunity. But investors are split on whether standalone pickleball facilities can become successful businesses. The lack of consensus has led to different concepts meant to attract broader audiences, ranging from facilities with craft food and karaoke rooms to courts in former warehouse spaces, accentuated in nightclub decor. Doing a project in a traditional manner is uninteresting to me, said Peter Rems, who founded Lucky Shots in Minneapolis. Mr. Rems, who has started several arts projects in the Twin Cities, added that he had modeled his pickleball building after a 1950s country club, splashed with a pink and green motif that combines vintage style with a contemporary edge. Lucky Shots opened in October in a 400,000 square foot space that once housed the Foley Manufacturing Company, a maker of kitchen tools. The Minneapolis Cider Company installed four indoor courts. Lifetime, which runs a national chain of fitness clubs, opened its first facility dedicated to pickleball in one of its former gyms in Bloomington, just south of Minneapolis. I've been in the health and fitness business for almost 40 years and never seen such organic growth, said Jeff Zweifel, Lifetime's chief operating officer. Smash Park is planning two pickleball sites in the Twin Cities. To distinguish itself from competitors, Smash Park is banking heavily on additional forms of entertainment to entice customers. Aside from pickleball, its facilities include axe throwing, karaoke, and private event space for up to 500 people. They also offer weekly events like trivia nights, Sunday brunch bingo, and murder mystery parties. Pickleball is fantastic, but quite low profit per square foot, said Monty Lockyer, Smash Park's chief executive. Because a court can have only two or four players active at a time, a location offering just pickleball would be unlikely to have enough clientele to keep it afloat, even with multiple courts, said Ronald Naples, an adjunct associate professor at New York University's Jonathan M. Tisch Center of Hospitality. Food and beverages are another way pickleball facilities are trying to drum up regular customers. The Pickle Bar in Somerville, South Carolina, will be spread across more than 40,000 square feet and have 9 outdoor courts with space for yard games like cornhole, but its focus will be on a bar and restaurant offering Southern cuisine, said Alyssa Tolliver, a co-founder. Across the Southwest, Eureka Restaurant Group is opening electric pickle locations influenced by the eatertainment model popularized by franchises like Topgolf and Chicken and Pickle, where food and drink complement a variety of recreational activities. Electric Pickle will feature items like handcrafted cocktails and Korean protein bowls in a setting with a speakeasy, rustic feel, said Paul Frederick, a Eureka co-founder, who added that the dining experience has to be the main draw. If I have 9 courts and the capacity is 4 per court, but the project capacity is 600 people, we have to indulge them in great food, a great scene, he said. We call it hitting all the sensories. Entertainment is particularly appealing now because customer wants have changed during the pandemic. With families seeking larger gathering spaces for leisure time, said Seung-Yun Park, an assistant professor in hospitality management at St. John's University. Entertainment facilities may not be the most appealing locales for dedicated players, though. Pickleball's demographics skew heavily toward retirees, and players have gained a reputation for being a prickly, territorial bunch. Much like tennis, the sport can also seem exclusionary. Some paddles cost more than $200. New York City is trying to accommodate demand for more courts, but won't renovate over heavily used recreational space like baseball or hardball courts, said Margaret Nelson, Deputy Commissioner for Urban Park Service and Public Programs at the city's Department of Parks and Recreation. We always try to balance, she said. People want to do a lot, and we have a finite amount of space. Some locations, like Raleigh in Charlotte, North Carolina, are hoping to challenge the belief that pickleball alone cannot anchor a business. Although Raleigh will include a food and beverage component, additional entertainment options are not on the menu. That term, entertainment, makes me cringe, says Barrett Worthington, a Raleigh co-founder. So many breweries and concepts throw together so many activities, but we want to have a bit more of a focused approach. With or without food and entertainment extras, finding affordable space is a universal concern among startup pickleball facilities. The first electric pickleball locations were being built from the ground up, but Mr. Frederick said he was exploring repurposed buildings for future locales because of rising supply chain costs and lengthy land entitlement processes. Repurposed spaces that formerly held big box or department stores are popular choices. Voli, a franchise based in Washington, is planning its first Texas location inside a 62,000 square foot former Hobby Lobby. Voli's first two locations were built inside 20,000 square foot plus furniture warehouses. Alan Jones, the founder and chief executive of Voli, previously built family adventure parks in abandoned grocery stores. Constructing an entertainment site in a repurposed space probably moves twice as fast as building from the ground up because necessities like parking lots and water and sewage systems are already set up, he said. Repurposing a big box store can present challenges too. For example, that low ceilings are not conducive to lob shots. Too many pillars can infringe on court space, which ideally measures 30 by 60 feet. Joe Berrigan, a co-founder of the Pickler, opened a location in Logan, Utah that once housed a Bed Bath & Beyond, and encountered other hurdles. He said there were high costs in removing drop ceilings and almost 20,000 square feet of flooring that had asbestos. Some landlords would not approve a lease at other prospective sites because of unfamiliarity with pickleball. With pickleball still largely considered a niche sport, some are selling the idea of a pickleball facility by not thinking of it as one at all. Inside Lucky Shots in Minneapolis, installations of large emoticons or phrases like "sup" emit a pop art feel. Since opening last fall, the club has signed up 9,000 members, many entranced by the ambience, Mr. Reams said. "What I do has nothing to do with pickleball," he said. "It's immersion in arts and culture that creates with a space in a physiological manner, so when they walk in, they feel something." And here's a tip, how to wash your hair in space. Water is limited, its globules escape. Gently scoop them back to your head. "Some of the water always floats away," said the retired astronaut Karen Nyberg, who spent 180 days in space, including 166 as a flight engineer on the International Space Station in 2013. In orbit, there's no running water, which means no showers. During her decades as an astronaut, people constantly asked Nyberg how she accomplished basic hygiene. One day on the International Space Station, she decided to film herself giving a hair washing tutorial. NASA put the video on YouTube, where it has been viewed by nearly 6 million times. In space, water is limited. Astronauts use foil and plastic water bags with straw-like nozzles. Don't use more than 8 ounces on a hair wash. "Put the nozzle right against your scalp," Nyberg says. "Squirt slowly, combining the liquid into your hair with your fingers. If water globules escape, use your cupped hands to gently scoop them back to your head. The rest will get caught in the air conditioning system and be recycled as drinking water. Work a small amounts of no-rinse shampoo into your hair and brush through with a comb. Rub your scalp with a washcloth and then add a bit more water to rinse. Use towels sparingly. There's no laundry in space and dirty items are thrown away." Nyberg likes to let her shoulder-length blonde hair dry in a hovering mane around her face. "You won't learn hair-washing tricks in astronaut training. Our trainers had never been to space," Nyberg says. "Rely on tips from those who've been there before." Recently, another astronaut posted a hair-washing video from orbit, citing Nyberg as her inspiration. "Consider bringing your own shampoo." Nyberg used a NASA-issued no-rinse variety that left an unpleasant residue. "Seek permission early. It can take months for NASA to evaluate and approve products." Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.